AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into a man who remains, well, arguably one of the most pivotal and intensely debated figures in that shift from the medieval world to the modern one, Christopher Columbus.
For a long time, the narrative was so simple, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He sailed the ocean blue in 1492, discovered America. End of story.
Exactly. But the stack of sources we've compiled for today, they reveal something far, far more complex. We're talking about a figure of staggering ambition, profound scientific miscalculation, but also
groundbreaking seamanship. You can't deny that.
You can't. And ultimately, catastrophic colonial impact.
That's precisely the tension we have to hold throughout this deep dive. We're looking at the man who inaugurated the Age of Discovery, and I think this is critical, the modern era.
Right.
Our sources, they really force us to focus not just on the moment of arrival, but on the immediate and the centuries-long consequences of his four Spanish-sponsored voyages.
Mm-hmm.
These took place between 1492 and 1504. And he really did, for better or worse, set the template for conquest.
So that's our mission today. We're going to navigate his journey, starting with that ambitious yet, you know, deeply flawed mathematical plan to reach Asia. Then we'll confront his tumultuous and frankly brutal tenure as a colonial governor.
And finally, we have to unpack the massive changes he unleashed. The demographic, the commercial, the social, everything we now call the Columbian Exchange.
It's a combination of skill, faith, and greed that, well, it reshaped global history. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
So let's start at the beginning. Christopher Columbus. He wasn't Spanish, which I think still surprises some people. He was an Italian explorer and navigator. What do the sources tell us about the humble origins of the man who would one day demand these incredible titles, like viceroy and admiral?
Well, his background was remarkably modest for someone who had achieved such lasting fame or infamy, depending on your perspective. He was born in the Republic of Genoa, probably between August and October of 1451.
And his father was a weaver?
A wool weaver, Domenico Colombo. He also owned a cheese stand. And the sources suggest that young Christopher actually worked there in the textile and food trade. So you get a real sense of his initial social standing. He was decidedly not born into the European nobility that he would later seek to emulate so desperately.
It's a classic rags-to-riches story in a way, although I guess the riches were heavily contested right to the end. How does a boy from a cheese stand vault into mastering the Atlantic? Going to sea at 14 seems incredibly young.
It's an aggressive move, for sure. But you have to remember that Genoa was a formidable maritime power. He was surrounded by shipping, by sailors, by tales of the sea.
It was in the air.
It was in the air. He goes to sea at 14 and starts accumulating this practical, hands-on navigational experience that was just invaluable. Our sources track him far and wide. He reaches the British Isles, likely visiting major trading ports.
Like Bristol in England.
Bristol, almost certainly, and maybe even Galway in Ireland. And then he sails as far south as the Guinea coast in West Africa, what we now call Ghana.
Wow. So he saw the Portuguese trading posts firsthand.
Exactly. Places like Elmina. This shows you he wasn't just some coastal sailor sticking to the Mediterranean. He was already engaging in high-risk, long-distance trade routes. He knew the business.
Which means he was already familiar with the Portuguese model of maritime exploration and commerce by the time he settles in Lisbon in the late 1470s.
Precisely. And Lisbon, at that time, was the absolute epicenter of Atlantic navigation. He was based there from 1477 to 1485, and this is where he really starts to build his life. He marries a Portuguese noblewoman, Filipa Moniz Perestrello.
And she was the mother of his son, Diego?
His legitimate son, yes. After she died, he moved to Castile in Spain and took a Castilian mistress, Beatriz Enriquez de Arana, who was the mother of his second son, Ferdinand. So these relationships really helped anchor him in the Iberian Peninsula, right at the center of Atlantic power.
And this is the crucial period where he transitions from being just a pragmatic sailor to a theoretical navigator. He was largely self-educated, which is amazing, but clearly very motivated. What was he reading? What texts were shaping his worldview?
He was a voracious reader. He devoured classical and contemporary geographical works. He read Ptolemy, the ancient geographer. He studied the wildly popular travel accounts of Marco Polo.
Which would have just fueled his imagination about the riches of the Far East.
Completely. And he read Pierre Daly's cosmological treatise, Imago Mundi. We know he read these things because his personal copies still exist, and they are covered in his own handwritten notes. He heavily annotated everything.
So he's taking all these scattered, sometimes conflicting pieces of ancient and medieval knowledge and trying to synthesize them into one single driving concept.
One singular obsessive concept. Reach Asia by sailing west.
A concept that was really fueled by a massive geopolitical crisis, wasn't it? The old route to the east had been, well, choked off.
Yes, the context here is everything. The fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks in 1453, that was a seismic event for Christian Europe.
It effectively slammed the door on the Silk Road.
It did. At least for Christian traders. The price of Asian spices, cinnamon, pepper, nutmeg skyrocketed. And this created immense economic pressure all across Europe to find another way, an alternative route to the East Indies.
So on one hand, his core motivation seems entirely mercantile. He wants to find a Western Sea passage and get rich from the spice trade. But the sources, they reveal a much deeper, almost medieval layer to his motivation. It wasn't just about money.
Not at all. And that's maybe the most fascinating contradiction in his character. His motivation wasn't purely profit-driven. It was deeply, deeply rooted in Christian millennialism and apocalypticism.
So he believed the end times are coming.
He saw himself as playing a role in it. He saw his voyages as part of God's divine plan. He wrote about this explicitly. He said he needed to acquire immense quantities of gold, not just for Spain, but specifically so that the Spanish monarchs could undertake and prepare to go conquer the Holy Sepulchre.
Liberate Jerusalem. He's combining cutting-edge global mercantilism with this ancient crusading goal. That's an extraordinary fusion of motives.
It connects his whole enterprise directly to the mindset of the Crusades. He believed that the wealth from Asia would finance the final necessary military action to reclaim the Holy Land. He was, in his own mind, an agent of prophecy, not just an agent of commerce.
And that religious fervor, that probably gave him the relentless, maybe even irrational persistence he needed to keep lobbying when every expert was telling him his math was completely wrong.
It had to be. And the Portuguese told him precisely that. They were the first to reject him, even though they were the world's leading experts in maritime exploration at the time.
Why? What was their reasoning?
King John II of Portugal shot down his proposal around 1484, and the reason was simple. Data. The king's expert advisors, his maritime commission, they correctly determined that Columbus had wildly underestimated the distance to Asia.
They had better numbers on the Earth's circumference.
Much better numbers. They were cautious, scientifically grounded navigators. Columbus was an audacious, religiously motivated dreamer. His math just didn't add up for them.
And besides, the Portuguese had a viable alternative already in the works.
Exactly. Their rejection was totally solidified when Bartolomé Dias successfully rounded the Cape of Good Hope in 1488. That confirmed the feasibility of the Cape route around Africa. For the Portuguese, Columbus's western route was just an unnecessary gamble based on flawed calculations. They already had a proven, though very long, way to the east.
So he turns to Spain. Spain had just completed the long and draining Granada War, finishing the Reconquista in early 1492. But he had to lobby for years, often living in poverty. What does that process tell you about his personality?
It speaks to an almost messianic self-belief. I mean, think about it. He's an outsider, a foreigner, a commoner. He's basically camping out near the Spanish court for years, sometimes receiving only a meager allowance, literally the annual salary of a common sailor, just to keep him from leaving and taking his big idea to a rival power.
He even tried England, right?
He sent his brother Bartholomew to England's court, and he got captured by pirates on the way. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. His persistence was just legendary.
And after all that waiting, all that political maneuvering, the stars finally aligned in 1492. The Catholic monarchs, Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand, they finally said yes.
They were finally persuaded by the promise of a massive competitive edge against their main rival, Portugal. Yeah. And with the Granada War over, they finally had the resources and the attention to spare.
Which led to the capitulations of Santa Fe in April of 1492. This was the contract. And the terms of this agreement were, well, they were shocking.
Absolutely shocking for the time. They promised him the titles of Admiral of the Ocean Sea, Viceroy, and Governor of all the lands he would discover or claim. And the key thing here is that these titles were hereditary, in perpetuity.
So they weren't just for him. They were for his children and his children's children forever.
Think about that. They were granting a common-born woolweaver's son the political and legal authority equal to high Spanish nobility and making those rights inheritable. It was unheard of.
And the financial terms were just as astounding.
Even more so. He was guaranteed 1/10, the dízimo, of all revenues the crown received from these new lands. Forever. Plus, he had the option to buy a 1/8 interest, the ochavo, in any commercial venture and receive 1/8 of those profits.
It's less like a contract and more like a blank check. Why on earth did the crown agree to such an absurdly generous deal?
Well, you have to look at it from their perspective. They were hedging against an enormous risk.
Yeah.
If he failed, if he sailed off and was never heard from again, the crown was out very little money. The initial investment was relatively small.
But if he succeeded?
If he actually succeeded and found a direct route to Asia, the profits would be so astronomically high that even giving away a 1/10 seemed like a reasonable price to pay for cornering the global spice trade.
What they didn't account for was the administrative nightmare and the centuries of legal battles that would follow. The pleitos colombinos.
The Colombian lawsuits. They were immense. Columbus's heirs spent centuries fighting the crown in court, insisting these hereditary contractual privileges be upheld. The legal battles lasted until 1790.
So the crown, once they saw the actual immense wealth of the New World, spent the next 200 years trying to claw back the titles and revenues they had so cavalierly granted to this desperate navigator in 1492.
It immediately created a political conflict that spanned the entire colonial period. It's a perfect illustration of just how high the stakes were. He was either going to be a nobody, lost at sea, or he was going to be one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in the world.
And all of this, this massive political and financial risk, was predicated on a theory that nearly every expert on the planet knew was wrong.
Right. And that brings us to one of the most persistent and frankly irritating historical myths surrounding Columbus. The idea that people thought the Earth was flat.
We have to clear this up. The popular story is that Columbus was this heroic scientific visionary battling medieval ignorance, and that everyone else thought he'd just sail off the edge of the world.
Complete and utter fiction. The truth, according to every credible source we have, is that nearly all educated Westerners at the time knew the Earth was spherical. That concept goes all the way back to antiquity.
To the ancient Greeks.
People like Eratosthenes and Posidonius. The church knew the Earth was a sphere. Navigators knew it. The debate was never, ever about the shape of the Earth.
So where did this powerful fabrication come from? Why do we all learn that in elementary school?
It was popularized much, much later. It really got going with 17th century Protestant writers who were trying to paint the medieval Catholic world as backward and ignorant. It was a form of propaganda.
And then it was cemented by a biography in the 1800s.
Yes. Washington Irving's highly influential 1828 biography of Columbus. He dramatized this fictional struggle between the navigator and supposedly ignorant clergy who believed the world was flat. It made for a great story, but it was just that, a story.
So what was the actual controversy? What was the real debate at the Spanish court?
It was purely logistical. The argument was about the planet's size and the simple practical question of whether a ship could possibly carry enough food and water to traverse the immense open ocean to get to Asia.
Okay, so this is where we have to look at Columbus's specific, spectacular mathematical blunders. It wasn't just one mistake. He made three compounding errors that resulted in his final calculation being, well, utterly useless.
Useless is a good word for it.
Mm-hmm.
The core of his plan was based on self-selected data and some very convenient misinterpretations. It was a mathematical house of cards he built for himself.
So let's break it down. Error number one was foundational. He underestimated the total circumference of the Earth.
He was heavily influenced by Ptolemy, the second century geographer from Alexandria. Now, more accurate measurements existed at the time.
Like from Eratosthenes, centuries earlier.
Who was remarkably accurate, by the way. But Columbus preferred Ptolemy's figures, which used smaller, old-fashioned units of distance. This preference, this cherry-picking of data, led him to underestimate the Earth's true size by nearly 1/3.
So right from the start, he's building his entire model on a version of the planet that is far too small.
Way too small. And that leads directly into the second error, where he has to manipulate the longitudinal size of the Asian landmass.
If you shrink the planet, you have to maximize the known land to reduce the ocean gap.
Precisely. Most experts at the time accepted a reasonable span for Eurasia, maybe 130 to 150 degrees of longitude.
Mm-hmm.
But Columbus, influenced by an older geographer named Marinus of Tyre, whose figures he read in the Imago Mundi, believed Eurasia spanned an enormous 225 degrees.
225 degrees. That's nearly two-thirds of the planet's circumference.
It's a massive overestimation. By using Marinus's inflated number, he placed the eastern coast of Asia, what he called Cipangu, or Japan, far, far closer to the western edge of Europe than it actually was.
So he's making the ocean smaller from both ends, shrinking the globe overall and then expanding Asia dramatically westward.
And the final nail in the coffin was his unit conversion error.
This is a classic case of misinterpreting the length of a mile.
A rookie mistake, almost. This third error involved him interpreting an estimate of a degree of latitude that was provided by a 9th century Persian astronomer, Alfraganus.
And Alfraganus used the Arabic mile,
which is quite long, about 1,830 meters. Columbus mistook this for the much shorter Roman mile, which is only about 1,480 meters.
So by using the shorter Roman mile, he calculated that each degree of travel represented a shorter actual distance than it really did.
It just compounded all the previous errors. So when you take his underestimated circumference, his vastly overestimated size of Asia, and his unit conversion error, his final calculation for the distance from the Canary Islands to Japan was just 2,400 nautical miles.
And the actual distance is?
The actual distance is 10,600 nautical miles.
Wow. That's staggering. It's a voyage almost five times longer than what he prepared for. The sources are clear. If the Americas hadn't been sitting there in the way, his voyage would have been a catastrophic failure.
Absolute disaster. Starvation, death, mutiny. No 15th century vessel could carry 10,600 nautical miles worth of food and water. So the unanimous conclusion of King John of Portugal's advisors was absolutely correct. Columbus was not a scientific genius. He was a man who was lucky enough that his mathematical errors put him on a collision course with an entirely unknown landmass.
A landmass situated right where his flawed calculations told him Asia should be.
The luck is incredible.
But sheer luck doesn't entirely explain his success. He was a master of practical navigation. What was the key navigational achievement that actually allowed him to survive?
His mastery of the Atlantic wind patterns, what the Portuguese called the Volta do Mar, which means the turn of the sea. This was crucial. His plan wasn't just to sail straight west and then try to sail straight back east. That would have been impossible. His genius was an understanding that the Atlantic was a giant loop.
Can you explain how that loop works for the listener?
Of course. For the outward journey, his plan was to sail south to the Canary Islands to catch the powerful northeast trade winds. These winds provided a reliable, fast push westward across the open ocean.
Okay, that gets him there. But the crucial part is the return.
The return is everything. If he tried to just turn around and sail back east against those same trade winds, he would be becalmed or beaten back. So, for the return trip, his plan was to sail northeast up into the middle latitudes of the North Atlantic to catch the westerlies.
The winds that consistently blow eastward back toward Western Europe?
Exactly. It's this strategic loop that allowed him to capitalize on the natural mechanics of the ocean currents and winds. It made the round trip feasible, whereas a straight line journey would have been a disaster.
It's the practical element that saved his theoretical hide.
It is. Now, he wasn't the first to know this. The Portuguese had been charting these routes for decades down the coast of Africa, but he was the first to successfully apply this knowledge to a transoceanic journey of this magnitude.
But even this knowledge was imperfect, right? He was still taking a huge risk.
A huge risk. By skirting the horse latitudes during hurricane season on that first trip, he could have easily run into a tropical cyclone or just been totally becalmed for weeks, either of which would have also ended the mission. That element of extraordinary luck just never goes away in his story.
So we have a man driven by prophetic faith and commercial greed, whose mathematical plan was absurdly wrong, but whose practical seamanship was just good enough, combined with incredible luck, to launch the Age of Discovery. Now let's see what happened when that flawed vision met reality in the Caribbean.
This is where everything changes.
We shift now to the execution, August 1492. Columbus leaves Palos de la Frontera with his three ships, the Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Niña. The voyage itself, it was arduous but ultimately successful, leading to that famous landfall on October 12, 1492.
A moment that is arguably the most consequential in all of global history. The initial landfall was on an island the natives called Guanahani. Columbus immediately renamed it San Salvador, which means Holy Savior.
And he was convinced he was in the East Indies.
Completely. He spent the next several months exploring the coasts of Cuba and Hispaniola, absolutely certain he was just off the coast of China or Japan.
And the sources, particularly his own journal, document his immediate and frankly shocking reaction to the indigenous inhabitants he met, the Lucayan, the Taino, and the Arawak peoples. This is where the shift from explorer to conqueror begins.
The shift is instant, and it's chillingly documented in his own words. He noted the inhabitants were simple in warlike matters, which was his way of saying they lacked European armor and steel weapons.
Military inferiority.
Exactly. But the very next sentence reveals his intent. He wrote that they should be good and intelligent servants. He then concludes that he could conquer them all with just 50 men and, quote, govern them as I pleased.
So he immediately saw their peaceful nature not as a virtue, but as a weakness to be exploited for forced labor and enslavement.
Instantly. There was no grace period. And he didn't just speculate about enslavement. He acted on it right away, taking several captive natives back to Spain at the end of that first voyage, including a young Lucayan boy he named Diego.
And then disaster strikes his little fleet.
It does. The flagship, the Santa Maria, runs aground off Hispaniola on Christmas Eve. He's forced to abandon it. Using its timbers, he establishes a rudimentary fort he names La Navidad in present-day Haiti. He leaves 39 of his men behind with very specific instructions. Find the source of the local gold.
Then he returns to Spain, a hero.
He returns in March 1493, a celebrated hero, though most European courts remained skeptical that he had actually found the Far East. But the news was electrifying enough to launch the massive undertaking that was the second voyage.
And this was not an exploration trip. This was a state-sponsored colonization project.
It was an armada. He sailed from Cadiz in late 1493 with 17 ships and around 1,500 people. This contingent included soldiers, yes, but also artisans, farmers, priests, civil servants, the entire infrastructure you'd need to establish permanent, self-sustaining European colonies.
And along the way, he's naming islands, claiming territory for Spain.
Absolutely. He's securing Spanish claims across the Lesser Antilles, naming islands like Dominica and Guadeloupe, and claiming Puerto Rico, which he called San Juan Bautista.
But the first thing he finds upon returning to Hispaniola is the total failure of his initial settlement, La Navidad. What happened there?
He found La Navidad in ruins, burned to the ground, and all 39 men dead. The sources are quite clear that the tragedy was instigated by the Spaniards Columbus left behind.
They turn on each other and the locals.
They quarreled intensely among themselves over the little gold they had found, and, most critically, they began raping native women and stealing food and property from the local Taino village. This led the local chief, the cacique Caonabo, to retaliate. He attacked and wiped out the entire fort.
So the very first European settlement set the tone. Violence, resource scarcity, and brutality.
It defined the early colonial experience from day one.
Columbus then establishes a new settlement, La Isabela, in the present-day Dominican Republic. And his time as governor begins instantly with crisis, mismanagement, and extreme violence.
The mismanagement was acute. La Isabela was poorly located in a swampy, unhealthy spot. The settlers started dying from tropical diseases and malnutrition. Supplies were limited. By late 1494, disease and famine had killed two-thirds of the Spanish settlers.
And the survivors, frustrated by the lack of easy gold Columbus had promised, became unruly.
They turned their frustration violently upon the native population. Columbus, struggling to maintain control of his own men, basically gave them license to range across the island and enforce Spanish control.
Which escalated into full-scale war. A war Columbus won using superior European technology and weaponry.
Yes. Faced with relentless Spanish rape, theft, and abuse, several indigenous leaders united their forces for war. Columbus defeated them decisively in battle, and this victory marks the transition from random skirmishes to institutionalized oppression. He formalized the encomienda system.
We need to define the encomienda system because it's absolutely central to understanding the historical critique against him.
It is. The encomienda system was, on paper, a trust system. The Spanish crown would entrust a group of indigenous people to an individual Spanish settler, the encomendero. In exchange for supposedly Christianizing them and protecting them, the settler was entitled to their labor and tribute.
But in practice?
In practice, it was a brutal, unpaid, forced labor system. It was slavery by another name, and its sole purpose was to extract wealth and control the local population.
And the specific tribute he demanded, the gold tribute, was almost impossible to meet.
He forced every Taino adult to pay a highly specific tribute. A hawk's bell filled with gold dust every 6 months. In areas where gold was scarce, they had to provide 25 pounds of spun cotton instead.
And the punishment for failing to pay.
The punishment for failing to pay, according to multiple contemporary accounts, including from figures like Bartolomé de las Casas, was horrific. Those who failed to produce the required amount of gold had their hands cut off and were left to bleed to death. It was a system designed to extract impossible wealth under the constant threat of mutilation and death.
It also fed his direct entrepreneurial interests in human trafficking. The sources confirm a massive slave raid in 1495.
Yes. In February of 1495, in one single operation, Columbus and his men rounded up about 1,500 Arawak people. He selected the 500 strongest and healthiest and shipped them back to Spain to be sold as slaves.
And the human cost was immediate.
200 of them died on the miserable journey across the Atlantic. This action confirmed the template. If gold couldn't be extracted from the ground fast enough, then human bodies would become the marketable commodity.
The relentless brutality and forced labor led to an equally devastating reaction among the indigenous population themselves.
Absolutely. The sources detail accounts of beatings, torture, and mass rapes inflicted by Spanish soldiers as they scoured the island for gold. This led thousands of indigenous people to commit suicide rather than face the oppression and forced labor. The Taino population, already suffering from newly introduced European diseases, began to collapse under the weight of this systematic violence.
So by the time of his third voyage in 1498, Columbus's governance is a complete shambles, but he still manages to achieve a great geographical milestone.
He does. He sails further south on this voyage and becomes the first recorded European to land on the South American mainland near the mouth of the Orinoco River in modern-day Venezuela. And he correctly surmised that this landmass was too vast to be just another island. It had to be a continent.
But true to form, he refused to accept the evidence of a new world because doing so would completely shatter his original theory.
It's the ultimate illustration of his self-imposed delusion. He clung so fiercely to his belief that he had reached the Far East. His rationalization for this massive new landmass was that South America must be the earthly paradise Eden itself, located, in his words, at the end of the Orient.
He wrapped his new geographical reality in a medieval religious fantasy rather than accept a revolutionary scientific truth.
He just couldn't let go.
And back in Hispaniola, his refusal to accept reality and his brutal governance finally came to a head. The Spanish settlers themselves were now in open rebellion.
The settlers were completely disillusioned. They hadn't found the promised riches. They were dying of disease. And Columbus's punishments were seen as excessive and tyrannical, even by the harsh standards of the time. Accusations of tyranny, torture, and incompetence started flooding back to the Spanish court.
What were the specific details that finally tipped the scales and convinced Ferdinand and Isabella they had to intervene?
The sources, specifically the official report filed by the royal commissioner, Francisco de Bobadilla, detailed some shocking atrocities committed by Columbus and his brothers.
So these weren't just rumors.
These were documented accusations. Bobadilla reported that Columbus had punished a man found guilty of stealing corn by having his ears and nose cut off. Even more shocking was the account of his brother Bartholomew ordering a woman to be publicly humiliated, paraded naked, and then having her tongue cut out for merely speaking ill of the admiral.
These are acts of extreme medieval-style cruelty that signaled total administrative chaos.
Exactly. So Bobadilla was sent to investigate, but he acted decisively and dramatically the moment he arrived.
He didn't just investigate.
He moved fast. He arrived in Hispaniola, took up residence in Columbus's own house, seized all his property, declared himself the new governor. And then, in October 1500, he arrested Columbus and his brothers and sent them back to Spain in chains.
An unbelievable, almost Shakespearean fall from grace. The Admiral of the Ocean Sea, the Viceroy of the Indies, arriving back in Spain as a prisoner.
It was a profound humiliation. While the monarchs immediately restored his freedom and his wealth, they pointedly refused to restore his governorship.
But he still secured one final chance, the fourth voyage.
His last voyage, from 1502 to 1504, was strictly an exploration mission. His objective was a desperate final search for a strait through Central America to the Indian Ocean. One last attempt to validate his original theory that Asia was just beyond the horizon. He ended up exploring the coast from Honduras down to Panama.
And this voyage is defined by a bizarre mix of extreme incompetence and stunning navigational foresight, particularly concerning a hurricane that hit Santo Domingo.
The foresight was undeniable. He arrived at Santo Domingo, and although he was denied port by the new governor, Nicolas de Ovando, Columbus accurately warned him of a massive approaching hurricane. He could read the signs in the sea and the sky.
And Ovando ignored him.
Ovando dismissed the warning and sent his massive treasure fleet, which, ironically, was carrying the now-deposed Bobadilla, directly into the path of the storm. Columbus, meanwhile, sheltered his own four small, fragile ships in a small river mouth.
The result was a complete catastrophe for the Spanish fleet.
20 out of 30 ships were lost. 500 lives, including Governor Bobadilla. All that gold, gone. Columbus's four ships survived. It was a near-miraculous vindication of his nautical skill mixed with the most profound tragedy for the Spanish administration.
The voyage still ended in complete failure, though. He was forced to beach his damaged, worm-eaten ships in Jamaica for a year, leading to one of the most famous anecdotes of his life, the eclipse prediction.
He and his men were stranded in Jamaica, starving, and Governor Ovando intentionally obstructed any rescue efforts, leaving Columbus marooned for nearly a year.
So they were running out of food.
Desperately. The native population, understandably tired of feeding these demanding Spaniards, threatened to stop provisioning them. So Columbus, using an astronomical almanac he had with him, calculated that a total lunar eclipse was going to occur on the night of February 29, 1504.
He used science as a tool of deception and power.
He absolutely did. He called the indigenous leaders together and told them that his god was angry at their refusal to provide food, and as a sign of divine displeasure, the moon would turn dark and bloody that very night.
And when the eclipse began,
the terrified natives begged him to intercede, promising to provision his men indefinitely if he would just bring the moon back. He pretended to speak to God and returned with a message that if they remained generous, the moon would return. It's an episode that perfectly encapsulates the duality of the man. A master astronomer and practical scientist using that knowledge for manipulation and survival. He was finally rescued 4 months later.
Columbus arrived back in Spain in November 1504, an exhausted and ill man. The sources describe his final years as being plagued by chronic illness.
He suffered from what were described at the time as severe bouts of gout, fevers, and temporary blindness. Modern experts, looking back at the descriptions of the joint inflammation, the high fevers, the recurring pain, they speculate he likely suffered from something called reactive arthritis.
Which is an inflammation triggered by an infection.
It's exactly. Probably acquired from food poisoning due to the appalling sanitation conditions on his long ocean voyages.
He died on May 20th, 1506, in Valladolid, but his focus until his last breath was on demanding that his promised riches and titles be upheld.
He never stopped fighting the crown. His insistence that the capitulations of Santa Fe were non-negotiable ensured that the legal conflict, the Pleitos Colombinos, would plague his heirs for nearly three centuries. He also spent his final years working on his Book of Prophecies, trying one last time to define his explorations not as a mercantile mission, but as the fulfillment of Christian destiny.
Even in death, his physical legacy remains profoundly unsettled. The location of his remains is famously disputed between Spain and the Dominican Republic.
It's a political dispute layered over a historical mystery. His remains were moved multiple times. First from Valladolid to Seville, then as he had wished to Santo Domingo. Then, when France took over Hispaniola in the late 18th century, the Spanish supposedly moved the remains to Havana and then back to Seville after the Spanish-American War in 1898.
So what's the current situation? Where is he?
Well, both locations claim to have him. The Seville Cathedral holds remains that were confirmed by a 2003 DNA analysis to belong to Columbus. They match the DNA of his documented brother, Diego.
That seems pretty conclusive.
It does. However, the Columbus Lighthouse in Santo Domingo also claims to hold his remains, which were supposedly found in a lead box in 1877. Crucially, the authorities in Santo Domingo have consistently refused to allow those remains to be DNA tested, leaving the question politically and historically contested to this day.
Now, when we turn to his historical legacy, we have to first confront the whole notion of discovery. He was clearly not the first European to arrive in the Americas.
Not by half a millennium. The Norsemen, figures like Leif Erikson, were the first documented Europeans to reach the North American mainland. They established a settlement in Newfoundland around 1000 CE.
So the narrative of him being the singular initial discoverer is just factually inaccurate?
It is. While most historians agree Columbus likely didn't know about this Viking precedent, his arrival is significant because it launched a period of sustained, permanent European contact. but it wasn't the first contact.
And the ultimate irony is that the continent isn't even named after him. It's named after Amerigo Vespucci, the man who corrected Columbus's greatest theoretical error.
It's the ultimate geographical judgment, isn't it? Columbus refused until his death to accept that he had found a new continent. He clung to the idea that he was off the coast of Asia. It was Vespucci who received the credit for recognizing the landmass as a new world, separate from Asia, leading to the continent being named America in his honor.
Now, let's shift to the most profound, irreversible impact of his voyages, the Columbian Exchange. This is often described as the true beginning of globalization.
It fundamentally reshaped the entire world. It's cited by scholars as a major turning point in human history. It was this massive two-way transfer of plants, animals, culture, technology, and most devastatingly, diseases between the old world and the new world.
Europe received things like corn, potatoes, tomatoes, and tobacco, which revolutionized their diets and demographics.
And the Americas received wheat, sugar, coffee, and livestock, like horses and cattle.
And diseases. The sources make the catastrophic scale of the depopulation clear, often estimating that the indigenous population of the Americas was reduced by about 90% in the century after contact.
That figure is staggering, and it was driven primarily by imported old world diseases, smallpox, influenza, measles, to which the indigenous populations, having evolved in isolation for millennia, had zero acquired immunity. It was a biological catastrophe that spread faster than the conquistadors themselves.
But historians are increasingly arguing that we can't attribute the entire collapse merely to biology. Human brutality and the systems of forced labor played a central genocidal role. Disease was only half the story.
This is a critical point raised by historians like Andres Resendez. While disease was the initial shockwave, it was the intense forced labor, the systematic brutality and enslavement that prevented any population recovery.
So the population couldn't bounce back like Europe did after the Black Death?
Exactly. They calculate that in the deadly gold and silver mines, a third of the workers died every 6 months. The indigenous populations in the Caribbean were given no time to recuperate between waves of disease because of constant warfare, overwork, starvation, and enslavement. The brutality amplified the lethality of the disease.
Which brings us back to the documentation of his specific actions. How reliable are the accounts of extreme brutality, given that Bobadilla, the man who wrote the most damning report, was also the man who wanted to seize power from Columbus?
That is the essential critical question. You always have to weigh the evidence. And while some historians dismiss the most severe accounts as part of the so-called Black Legend, that's anti-Spanish, anti-Catholic propaganda designed to demonize their colonial project, the fact remains that multiple, often separate sources confirm a general atmosphere of terror and excessive cruelty under his rule.
So even if the report was compiled by a political rival, the core actions, the massive slave raids, the impossible gold tribute, the documented mutilations, we can't fully dismiss those.
No, you can't.
Yeah.
We know that the Spanish court itself reacted with horror to the level of disorder and the specific acts of mutilation and torture. No. That's why they sent Bobadilla in the first place and why they stripped Columbus of his titles, even after releasing him from his chains.
Right.
So whether the accounts were slightly exaggerated or not, they confirm Columbus initiated a cycle of resource extraction, violence, and systematic slavery that set a genocidal tone for all subsequent colonial endeavors in the New World.
And what about the defense that he was merely a phenomenon of the times, just doing what everyone else was doing in the 15th century?
That defense argues that he simply brought the entrepreneurial form of slavery to the New World. But while slavery was certainly practiced in 15th century Europe and by the Portuguese in Africa, the scale, the systematic use of forced labor, and the specific savagery with which it was implemented under Columbus, who was trying to replicate the immense profits of the African slave trade, made it a new level of exploitation. He was an innovator in colonial brutality.
For centuries, particularly in the United States, none of this complexity seemed to matter. Columbus was a massive cultural icon, often functioning as a substitute founder for the nation.
He became a crucial unifying symbol, especially the early U.S. colonies. Puritan writers latched onto his story to represent the developing American spirit, a figure of audacity and expansion who could help forge a national identity separate from the old British monarchy. His name, Columbia, even became the national personification of the United States.
And this idealization really peaked in the 19th century, transforming his landing into a kind of sacred image of American genesis.
The visual representations from that time are very telling. You can look at the sculpture commissioned for the U.S. Capitol building in 1844, Discovery of America. It depicts a triumphant Columbus standing over a figure described at the time as a cowering Indian maiden.
Wow.
The art explicitly reflected and reinforced the 19th century view that Native Americans were intellectually and morally inferior and that they deserved to be conquered.
He wasn't just a political symbol, though. He was also adopted as an ethnic hero, which adds another important layer to the history of the celebrations.
Absolutely. The huge commemorations for the 400th anniversary in 1893, like the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago, they solidified his iconic status. But crucially, as immigration soared, groups like Italian and Irish communities latched onto Columbus as a non-Anglo-Saxon Catholic founding figure. He became a tool for their own assimilation and validation within American society.
Which is why the contemporary debate over his monuments can be so emotional. For some of those groups, removing a statue of Columbus can feel like an attack on their own history and their acceptance into America. But since the 1990s, that heroic narrative has been fundamentally challenged.
The modern reassessment really gained serious traction around the 500th anniversary in 1992. The academic focus shifted dramatically from discovery to encounter, emphasizing the agency of the indigenous peoples and the devastation they experienced.
And this scholarly critique has now fully spilled over into public action, particularly in the last few years.
We've seen a clear, large-scale public reaction, especially following the major social justice movements of 2020. There's been a systematic wave of public monument removals, statues being pulled down, or officially taken out of public squares.
It reflects a broad societal shift.
It does. A shift where the narrative of heroic discovery can no longer outweigh the documented history of colonial oppression and the subsequent devastation of indigenous populations. His legacy today is fundamentally inseparable from the catastrophic human cost of the systems he initiated.
It's a powerful movement reflecting the fact that these two narratives, heroic navigator versus genocidal tyrant, they just can't coexist peacefully in the public square anymore.
And that tension is why he remains so relevant. He embodies the historical conflict right at the start of our modern world. That fervent, faith-driven desire for economic expansion and global reach set against the devastating violence and depopulation required to make that ambition reality.
He was a creature of transition, bridging that prophetic medieval crusading zeal with modern global commercial enterprise.
And the sources show us that he was a man who, despite his immense navigational skill, actively resisted the truth of his own achievement. He refused to acknowledge the new world he had found.
That resistance to reality, that self-imposed delusion, is the key, isn't it? He saw a continent, correctly identified it as vast, yet insisted it was the earthly paradise at the edge of Asia, because his flawed map told him it should be.
He had the physical evidence right in front of him, yet he preferred the certainty of his flawed theory.
So here's a final thought for you to take away. Consider the irony that Columbus refused to acknowledge he found a new continent, preferring instead to cling to the belief that he had reached the Far East.
How did this self-imposed delusion, this resistance to seeing the new world and its inhabitants as they truly were, rather than what his faith and ambition dictated they should be, how did that lay the foundation for the centuries of violent exploitation and denial that followed his initial encounter?
It suggests that the conquest wasn't just a physical act of war and disease. It was also an intellectual refusal to acknowledge the humanity and uniqueness of the lands and peoples he encountered, setting the stage for their systematic devaluing and destruction. That resistance to reality is what we must continue to mull over.